Well, we have some wonderful guests today on Conversations. I am absolutely thrilled to have my favorite authors of Conscious Loving and many other books on the show, Kathryn and Gay Hendricks. Kathryn has been a pioneer in the field of body-mind integration for over 30 years. Her explorations of the catalytic transformational power of the creative arts has been featured in many magazines, journals, and books. Gay Hendricks has served for more than 30 years as one of the major contributors to the fields of relationship, transformation, and body-mind therapies. Gay and Kathryn have authored many best-selling books, including Conscious Loving, which is used as a textbook in many graduate programs throughout the country, and is a Bible for marriage and family therapists. So welcome to Conversations, Gay and Kathryn.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thanks, Michael.
Wonderful to have you here. Let's just jump right in and start out. What do you mean when you talk about a conscious versus unconscious loving relationships, or just conscious versus unconscious loving?
Yes. Well, one thing that we noticed early on is that a lot of when we were in relationships in our teens and 20s, I noticed that I didn't figure it out at the time, but as I began to think about why these relationships weren't working in my 20s, I realized that it was because I was recreating old unconscious patterns without even realizing it, that I was doing things exactly the same way that I soaked up by osmosis ways my parents and grandparents related to each other. And I realized that that I was creating these old patterns unconsciously, and I realized that I needed to look at what that was producing and do something different and try to find out some new conscious programming to install there, because my old unconscious program was making me miserable and keeping me from having the kind of love I wanted in my life. And so it took me into my 30s to kind of figure all that stuff out, but finally, when we got together, we made a number of conscious agreements and set some conscious intentions for how we wanted our relationship to be. And that set in motion an incredible amount of transformation that, you know, led us ultimately to write our books and start teaching our seminars, and all the talk shows and things like that came out of that original desire to try to put in some conscious programming that replaced the old unconscious stuff that was making us unhappy.
I also think of conscious as having more choices, that if I'm unconscious, I'm kind of sleepwalking or in a trance. And so many people are in a trance about their relationships and only think they have a limited number of choices, or actually don't even consider that they can make choices about, for example, whether they speak to each other authentically or whether they listen. Most people, I think, without considering it, kind of just sleepwalk through their relationships. And so being conscious, I think one of the benefits of being conscious is that you get more choice in your day-to-day interactions, and that if something is going in a direction that doesn't feel alive and satisfying, you can do something different, that you don't have to simply complain about it or try and control your partner, or, you know, those limited number of choices that most people grow up with. And so we've spent many, many years taking a look at what are the benefits of being conscious, and there are really a lot of them. You get to have more fun and be more creative solve problems more quickly.
Yeah, well, like, for example, unconscious programming, like for me, when I was growing up, I grew up in a family where people never talked about emotions. You know, maybe once a month they'd have a giant anger blow up, but, you know, nobody ever said anything like, I felt hurt, or I felt scared, or I feel sad, or I feel happy, or there was no dialogue about emotions. And one of the things that makes a relationship work is that you need to be on good terms with your feelings so that you can talk about things as they come up and talk about your feelings about things. And that's just part of the vocabulary and the language of relationship. And so it was kind of like walking into a foreign country where I didn't know the language. And I realized that my old unconscious programming was to seal off myself from my emotions. That's the way I'd seen it done. But what I failed to notice there was that, you know, people as a result of that didn't have very good relationships, because they either talked about trivial things that had nothing to do with anything important. They avoided talking about the important things, or they would let their emotions build up until now and then they would just blow their stack and trash the other person out. And so what we did was figured out all of the different ways we could be in touch with our emotions and speak honestly about those. That was another thing. Unconsciously, we'd both been programmed not to speak honestly about what was really going on with ourselves and in our relationship. And so we decided to put in some new conscious programming about that it was okay to speak honestly, and it was okay to be in touch with our feelings. And so gradually, we replaced that old programming throughout our 30s and 40s, so that you know, now that we know this new way of being, we don't have to slip back into that old stuff that made our parents and grandparents so miserable.
I'm always amazed when I'm speaking to someone, particularly in relationship, and all of a sudden I hear my father, the colonel's voice, coming out and saying things, and I'm
where,
you know, it, but it's really good to be able to start to catch it, because evidently that's been going on for quite a few decades now, and I'm starting to hear, and I go, oh my God, that's my father's voice. That's, what do I really feel about that? One of the things you talk about is a co-commitment and a co-creative relationship. Kathleen, can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, yes. I'm so excited about co-creativity, because for so many years, people have thought that creativity had certain rules about it. One was that you had to be by yourself, and so you could either be creative or be in a relationship. And that's a mythology that a lot of people still believe, that that, you know, a relationship kind of saps your creativity. And what we have found in exploring the benefits of the things we were just talking about being conscious, is that you liberate a huge amount of free time and creativity. Because I don't think people realize how much of their energy, their daily energy, and their creative juice gets sapped by conflict and power struggles. And when you learn different things to do about that, one of the big benefits is that you liberate your creativity, and then you begin to look at your partner not as so much as an improvement project or a control project, but someone whose creativity you can support. And so rather than having one partner or the other be creative, you enter into this whole new frontier, which is co-creativity, the combined energy of each person's creativity is really more than each person has on their own. That's one of the things we noticed really early on, was that our combined energy gave both of us more creativity, and that we were able to create more together. It's almost as if we created a whole third entity, kind of the co-creative relationship. We have Gay and Katie, and then the co-creative relationship. And so we have much more energy and creativity than we had before we got into relationship with each other.
Wow. And that resistance takes an enormous amount of energy holding it down. In fact, you say in one of your books that resistance to love is what causes most of the problems. Talk about that a little bit. What do you mean?
Well, most of us, when we're growing up, we have love that comes into us that's also flavored by other things, you know, like the love might be flavored by control, or it might be flavored by abuse of some sort. And so what happens is you begin to develop defenses against love because you're afraid of being wounded or poisoned by the toxic elements of things that come in with it. And so what happens as a result of that is that you begin to define yourself by resisting love. And so then when love starts showing up in the form of other people that are outside your family, you know, in your teens and 20s and so forth, you begin to defend yourself against that because you're afraid that it's going to bring with it the same things that caused you pain earlier in your life. And so that's the general scenario that causes people to define themselves by resistance to pain, resistance to love and positive energy. It's a kind of a filtering system where you try to hold out the toxic elements of what you fear is going to happen, but at the same time you hold out love, and you confuse love that's coming in from other people in your present now with things that caused you pain early on in your life.
Katie, could you share an example of that from your experiences?
Oh, well, I...
I'm sure you have many.
I have many. From my own personal experience, one of the things that has been the most meaningful for me was separating out, beginning to let go of the filter that I got attached onto love of criticism. That when I was growing up, love was always accompanied by something that was wrong. You know, I'm only telling you this for your own good. I'm telling you this because I love you. You know, if you would only, you know, do this or do that or be different, that was what came with love. And so I developed a listening filter for criticism, that I thought that that's what love was about, that it was glued to criticism. And I remember the moment where I really saw that so clearly, when I came home from getting my hair cut one day and I walked in the door, and I hadn't told Gay that I was going to get my hair cut, and I walked in and Gay looked up and he said, "Oh, you got your hair cut." And I said, "Oh, what's wrong?" Without a missing a beat. You know, I had it so glued to having attention and love connected with criticism that that's what I heard, even though it wasn't intended. And just like you were hearing, Michael, with your father's voice coming out of your mouth, in that moment, I heard myself. And that was a moment where I began to be able to sort out, oh, Gay's not critical. Gay's giving me attention. Oh, Gay's giving me love. Oh, Gay isn't meaning to criticize me. And then I began to be able to sort out and release criticism and receive more and more love and attention free of that. It was a very liberating moment.
God, I can so relate to that with a military colonel and a stepmother whose maiden name was Severe. Dickens would like that. But you know, then I find that I have carried that into relationships, not meaning to be that way, but being critical of the people I've been in relationships with.
Yeah, without having I think one of the biggest gifts that we can give ourselves and that we can give our partners is curious attention, that moment of, you know, most everybody gets defensive, but that moment of shifting into being curious of, oh, where did that come from? Or, where did I learn that? Or what do I really want here? Those moments allow us to shift from those unconscious programming into really being able to give and receive love much more freely.
Well, that's great. One of the things I'd like to talk about with you is the whole issue of codependence. You say in one of your books that inequality is the hallmark of codependence. What do you mean by that? And let's talk a little bit about issues of codependence and what's behind that.
One aspect of that, Michael, is that in relationships, if you aren't secure about your own self-esteem, in other words, if you think you are fundamentally unlovable inside, what happens is that then you go out and get into relationships with the wrong intention, the intention of getting someone else to love the part of you that you don't love. And lo and behold, you attract into your life usually somebody that has exactly the same issue. They don't love themselves, and so they're trying to get you to love them for what they haven't been able to love yet. And so it becomes two dogs chasing their tails around the room because they're each trying to get the other one to do something they can't even do for themselves. And so that's really, in a way, one of the hallmarks of codependence is you're wanting someone to fulfill a part of you that maybe you don't even know is missing. You know, that, like, for example, what often happens in couples is one of them might be very logical and linear, and the other one might be very emotional. And a codependent relationship, what happens is, you know, like I used to see this in Katie's parents, somebody would ask Bob, her dad, some question, and Katie's mother would answer the question for him, you know? And what would you like for dinner, Bob? And Polly would chime in and say, oh, he likes soup on Thursday night.
Yeah. Or tonight's chili night.
Yeah, and he got away with being a very shy, unexpressive guy because she did all the talking for him throughout his life. And so same thing with lots of other different things in relationship. You know, there's the logical and the emotional couple. One of them is very logical. One of them is very very emotional. And what should happen in a situation like that is they should be able to learn from each other so that the logical one learns from the emotional one how to be better at their emotions, and the emotional one can learn from the logical one how to think more clearly and linearly in those situations where that's appropriate. And so that's a co-creative relationship where you're learning partners with the other person. Codependence has to do with a fundamental inequality because you're saying to the other person, you're not my equal. And I'm not your equal. And so you become then enmeshed in an entanglement. That's what we call it, an entanglement, that where you're not both working on being whole people with your own full creative independence and appreciation of the world.
Uh-huh. I'm thinking of another example of the kind of polarity that shows up a lot in the first part of our relationship. Gay is much more, likes to spend more time by himself, and I like to spend more time around people. He's more of what we would call an introverted person. I'm more extroverted. And that's a situation where, you know, that's rife for conflict and trying to control the other person. And instead of doing that, we early on made the decision, which I think is such a liberating decision, to see what we might learn from each other. And I've learned how to really spend time by myself and really enjoy being in direct relationship with the universe and in listening to my intuition and just being in kind of the hum of the universe. And Gay has learned how to be around people and enjoy being around people. And, of course, we still both have our same preferences, but we've been able to really expand our range of choices by learning from each other rather than making each other wrong.
Uh-huh. I just want to say to our listeners, if you just tuned in, we're talking to Kathleen Hendricks and Gay Hendricks, pioneers in the field of body-mind integration and relationships for decades. I won't say how many decades, but a few decades you've been doing that. And I want to back up just a little bit and go back to something you just said a minute ago, Gay. I kind of want to underline it. The whole issue behind codependency, the feelings of lack of self-love or self-acceptance, I think a lot of people can relate to that when they actually look at it. So how do you change that? How do you begin to then nourish yourself, and especially when you're in a relationship when there's so much together and a need for maybe time to be apart to do that? How do you nourish that self-love or self-acceptance so that you can be a better partner?
Well, any kind of serious, deep self-change needs to begin with a personal commitment. And so the way you begin to change something like that, let's say in our relationship, for example, we've been together 29 years now, as of this week, I guess, huh?
That's right.
Yeah, so we've been, we met 29 years ago this week. And early on, we had that polarity of I was the more logical, linear one that was cut off from my feelings, and Katie was more the expressive person who was more in touch with her emotions. And so the problem begins there when you make your version of reality right and make the other person's version of reality wrong. So the first thing I needed to do was make a personal commitment to taking on her style as a learning edge for myself, you know, to commit to learning about emotions so that I didn't come off as being half a person in my relationship with her. And, Katie, you had to do the same thing.
Yes, too. And I was just thinking, too, that making that decision is really an outward expression of valuing the other person. So rather than trying to keep the other person out or making yourself right, which is such a relationship killer, when you say, I'm really interested in how you experience life and what I can learn from that, that in itself expresses value and creates intimacy.
Yeah, so one of the key things to do is to make a commitment to whatever change you want to make. It's also great to make a co-commitment in the sense that two people then make a mutual commitment to transforming whatever element you're working on, whether it's your arguing or whatever it is, that the magic really takes off when both people can make a commitment to making a change in a given area. It's possible to make a change in a relationship with just one person changing, but it sure works a lot faster if both people are willing to commit to that.
Well, let's talk about commitment.
It's a lot more fun, too.
Say it again, Katie.
It's a lot more fun.
Absolutely. But let's go a little deeper into this area of commitment, because I know many people who are scared to death of a commitment, and the relationship is kind of what can I say? It's okay, I'm going to watch you and see if you fulfill the things that I think you should do. So it's a conditional, you talk about 100% responsibility in a relationship. So can you talk more about the issue of commitment and what that really means with somebody like yourselves that have had a 3-decade relationship?
Yeah, anything new in your life, whether it's in your own personal relationship or with a partner, really begins with commitment. And we've seen that so many people are confused about what commitment really is and have it confused with having their options limited. For example, most people think of commitment as, you know, you better have your fun now because when you get committed, it's all over. And what we've really found is that commitment is a wonderful place to come home to and also a great way to steer your change, because it when you commit, you're actually gathering yourself and taking yourself in a chosen direction. So it's really an action. It's not a moral issue. It's really an action that you take. And then when you drift from that action, you can simply recommit. So it's not just committing, it's really recommitting that makes the difference. So Gay and I made a commitment to each other early in our relationship to drop criticism, and we committed to appreciating each other rather than criticizing each other. So that commitment is then a place to launch from, but it's also a place to come back to, because when we found ourselves criticizing, you know, of course you make a commitment and then the first thing that's going to happen is you're going to be challenged about that commitment, you know, rather than lamenting or saying, well, we really failed there, we learned how to recommit and continue taking actions in the direction of the where we wanted to go. So when we realized we were criticizing, we would drop that and then right in that moment actually shift into finding something that we genuinely appreciated about each other and expressing that, and we began to make the commitment real by those repeated actions.
Yeah, and let me give you another example, Michael, and that is in relationships, a lot of people don't understand how commitment works. They think a commitment is kind of a, well, let me put it the other way around. What a commitment really is that works is a commitment to certain processes. Like in the old days when people would do their marriage vows, they would make a vow to love, honor, and obey the other person. Okay, well, you can't really make a commitment to love somebody because that's trying to control something that you don't have any control over. What you can do is make a commitment, though, to speak honestly to the other person about how you're feeling, so that someday maybe you wake up not feeling particularly loving toward the person. Then you have a real skill that you can use. If you can say, today, I don't feel very loving toward you. I feel angry toward you. Well, the moment you say that, the anger might disappear, and then poof, you feel loving toward the person again. But if you seal off all of that and don't speak honestly about how you are and who you are and what you're feeling, what happens then is that distance grows in the relationship because you haven't made a commitment to what we call processes. So we think that process commitment is important, committing to things that you actually have some ability to control, like whether or not you're speaking honestly. Or let's say another one, appreciation. It does absolutely no good whatsoever to make a commitment to feeling appreciative of your partner. What works magic, though, is to make a commitment to something that you have control over, which is speaking appreciation to your partner. And so in our work, for example, we have people make commitments to things they can actually do, like to speak 5 appreciations a day to the other person, or to listen carefully to the other person without making a judgment or interrupting them. Things that you actually have control over that in the long run produce a deeper feeling of love. So one of the biggest misunderstandings about commitment is not realizing that what you really need to commit to are processes and things you can do with the other person.
That's so powerful. I love that. I'm thinking of the times when someone has said to me, and I'm sure other people have some experience of this, I love you. And there's this, like, I love you with a hand to the ear, expecting back, I love you too. And,
yeah.
You know, it's like the John and Marcia kind of thing. But there's something very inauthentic about that in its nature, because sometimes somebody has just done something and they say, I love you, and it's kind of a manipulative thing, and they accept you say it back. And you might want to say, hey, buzz off. I'm not feeling very positive about being with you right now. I kind of want to be alone, and I'll talk to you later, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know, it's almost like trying to elicit something out of you that you're not feeling. I guess that's a codependent behavior.
That would be a codependent behavior and an expectation of reciprocation rather than speaking what's authentically going on in the moment, which is a process that people can learn how to do that makes a huge difference in the quality of their relationships.
Well, in your book, Conscious Loving, you talk about the essential elements of a co-committed relationship. Can you just go through those for our listeners? A few of them anyway?
Sure.
One of them that is, in case we run out of time, we want to make sure we mention this one because it is so important and possibly the most violated issue in relationship work, and that is that many people do not know how to get out of blame and criticism in a relationship. In other words, they've grown up in such an atmosphere of criticism and blame that it almost seems natural and normal to blame the other person when things get tough, or even to blame themselves. But one thing that we've figured out is how to eliminate blame and criticism from relationships. So, for example, we haven't had an instance of blame or criticism in our house in years and years and years, probably 10 or 15 years. And so it's possible to create a life where you're not going around criticizing and blaming either yourself or the other person. And I grew up in a family that was incredibly critical. And so I, when I first started out in relationships, it seemed like the natural thing to do. When some problem came up, I immediately blamed it on the other person.
Well, naturally.
Naturally. There was a problem. It's
it was
their fault. Yeah. And we figured this out, and after working on it for a number of years, we realized that the only way to handle that particular problem was in taking full responsibility, each of us taking full responsibility for the issue that came up. Let's say that we got into a disagreement or argument about getting to some place on time. I remember we had a hassle sometime in our first few years together about getting to a Willie Nelson concert on time.
Oh, yes.
And I remember that very vividly because I could almost hear my grandfather's voice coming out of my mouth, and I could almost hear Katie's mom's voice coming out of her mouth, where in my experience of her parents, they had that same type of critical, blameful thing that my grandparents did. And so here we were, I was kind of speaking blame to Katie that it was her fault that we were late, and she was speaking blame to me that it was my fault. And it's kind of like that dog chasing a tail around, that neither one of us would accept responsibility for it ourselves. But the magic happens when, we able to say, oh, okay, why am I blaming you in this situation? And why are you blaming me? And once we kind of realized that we were just putting all of this blame on the other person and not taking responsibility for it ourselves, once that became clear to us, suddenly we walked into the Willie Nelson concert, and we actually walked in, even though technically by the clock we were about half an hour, 45 minutes late, so had been the concert, unbeknownst to us. And so when we walked in, it was almost like the moment we walked in, they hit the first note. And it was a big learning experience for us, because we realized that here we had imposed this whole pattern of blame and criticism on each other for an hour and a half while we were driving to the concert, all about something that eventually was a total non-issue.
That's great. I want to tell our listeners, just a second, Katie, I want to tell our listeners, if you wanted to have more information on the work of Gay and Katie Hendricks, then you should go to hendricks.com. And towards the end, we'll talk also about the Gaia Illumination University. Go ahead, Katie.
Yes, what I was going to say is that people don't realize that there's another option for blame and criticism. I think most people, since most of us have grown up with that, we actually think it works, that if in order to really express caring for another person, we've got to blame or criticize them. And what we found from the example that Gay was just telling you and many other shifts is that what really replaces blame and criticism is wondering, is getting genuinely curious. And when you shift from blame to wonder, you actually reclaim your creativity, because you're actually using your creativity to create the interlock, the entanglement of who gets to be right. And when you release that lock, you liberate your creativity, and you can wonder about, what kind of relationship do I really want? What do I want to be putting my attention on, rather than recycling the blame and criticism, which only has one ending. One person's going to apologize, or you're going to get distant from each other for a while, and then you'll cover it up and, kind of get back into the same pattern. But when you shift into wonder, that liberates this enormous amount, this infinite amount of creativity, and then you can focus on what you do want rather than on what you don't want.
Sounds like moving from control to curiosity.
Yes.
It's lovely.
That's
a great way to put it.
Yeah. I want to get back a little bit just to give a little template to people, because you have, like I said, the essential elements of co-committed. You have something about seven steps to a co-committed relationship. Some of the things that you say are so brilliant about the microscopic truth and the, you know, those things. Could you just go through some of those and give us a few pointers around that? Some of them you've covered, I know.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the microscopic truth, because that is a big healer in relationship. We've seen that just work so many miracles with so many hundreds of couples. One thing we learned early on is that in our way of speaking to the other person, we almost like transferred blame unconsciously to the other person just in our way of speaking. Like if you say to somebody, "You made me angry when you said that," right away, you're putting yourself in the victim position, that you're the victim of the way that person spoke to you. But 2 seconds thought about that will show you a lot of times that, interesting. Why would I attract, let's say I've had 13 different relationships in my life, why would I attract the same type of pattern in each of those relationships with 13 different people? And the reason is because based on your own childhood programming, you unconsciously require a person to step into that position with you. Let's say you have an expectation of criticism in your life. Well, then you require another person to be critical of you. And so we found that learning to speak the microscopic truth was incredibly important to us. So instead of saying, "You made me angry today when you did such and such," we would switch it around and go microscopic and tune in inside and say, "When you said such and such a little while ago, I felt my stomach tighten." Now that reports the truth microscopically, and it doesn't imply blame. It just says that two things happened. And it's a much better way to communicate with each other, because then you don't end up slinging blame back and forth just in the way you speak to each other. Or like if I say, "I have to go to the dentist this afternoon." Well, the way of speaking there, "I have to go to the dentist," puts me in a victim position with regard to my appointment schedule and my dentistry. You know, that suddenly it's a burden I have to do. And there's absolutely no reason to speak of it like that. You could speak of it with microscopic truth and say, "When I think about going to the dentist this afternoon, I feel kind of a clench. I'm remembering last time when I didn't, you know, when things didn't go well there and they had to come back and do it again. I just went through a big dentistry drama last year where I was back and forth to the dentist a bunch of times," and I would find myself slipping into the victim position rather than saying, "Okay, I want to have a healthy set of teeth and I'm choosing to do this," instead of saying it like, "I got to go to the dentist again today."
So telling the microscopic truth, what we learned is, and why we call it the microscopic truth, is that you're describing your experience very closely, and describing it has been very important to me, rather than making a judgment or criticizing my own experience. I'm instead describing what's going on for me, you know, as if I were looking through a microscope. And that way of describing imparts curiosity. It allows me to discover what's really going on, and it allows me to talk in a way that doesn't blame anybody. And that skill, I think, above any other, is the one that I keep coming back to, because it creates the most immediate intimacy. It creates the most vitality for me, and it isn't anything that requires a response from the other person. It makes a bridge to the other person while making a bridge to my own inside, my discovering of what's actually going on. And I found so often that when I begin to talk to Gay, just from what I'm experiencing, you know, what I'm thinking, what images are coming to my mind, what body sensations I'm experiencing, then I get to discover what that's really all about. But if I try to, I came from a background where I would go off and kind of package up what I was going to say and then come back and present it in, you know, a neat little package with a bow on it. And when I shifted from that to kind of speaking from discovery, that made a huge difference in my feeling that the relationship is a place where I get to keep learning. You know, so in most relationships, I think people think they come to kind of the end of it. They start taking each other for granted. They start feeling like they can finish all of their partner's sentences because they just know everything there is to know. And my experience in being with Gay every day is that I have a sense of the deepening of our relationship and the freshness, a kind of fresh newness at the same time. And I never realized that was possible in an ongoing relationship, that I could keep renewing it and deepening it at the same time. And I think that's one of the benefits of learning how to speak the microscopic truth.
Another thing that's incredibly important, Michael, is that both people in a relationship make a commitment to their own creative development. Because we've seen so many dozens, hundreds perhaps of examples of relationships where one person is more committed to their creativity than the other person, and it ends up with creating hassles in the relationship because the one who hasn't made a commitment to their creativity blames the other person for spending so much time doing whatever that creative thing is. But the solution is never to stop doing what you're creative at. The solution is for both people to make a passionate commitment to whatever their own creative path is so that they keep that creativity part of themselves alive. I've worked with so many people who, you know, stopped doing whatever creative thing they were doing, whether it was poetry or dance or music or whatever it was, when they got together with another person and had kids, and all of the things of daily life gradually kind of get in the way and you lose that commitment with your creative edge. And that's a real disaster, because when that creative flow of energy is dammed up inside, all sorts of physical symptoms even come out of that, you know, that people get sick more when they're not embracing their creativity, and they certainly have a lot more relationship arguments when they're not fully in touch with their creativity. So it's a big, very important thing.
Another aspect of that, Katie, you don't know this, but I also have a background in moving meditation and body awareness, and I know that's a part of your background too. And so many people have a difficult time expressing their feelings. How do they feel? Mm-hmm. And what I'd like you to address is the aspect of feelings in relationship to the body, to help people be able to sort that out and begin to actually be able to say what they're feeling.
Oh, yeah, it's a great question. And it is one large aspect of our live trainings. We have a weekend workshop we call Foundation, where we really teach people these basic skills that we're talking about today. And the skill of being able to notice what's going on in your body and notice that those body sensations are connected to your emotions is one of the things we cover. So the shorthand version of that is that people have feeling zones in their bodies where body sensations are most connected with the big three feelings that, if people are not aware of them, get them into the most trouble. So across your shoulders, the back of your neck and your jaw is the anger zone, just like it is for all animals. All animals, when they're trespassed on, or, you know, they get, you know, someone comes into their territory or there is an inequality that happens, animals get their hackles up. And so if people can learn to recognize a tension at the back of their neck or tightness in their shoulders as an indicator of anger, that's very useful, because your body sensations are often going to get there before your cognitive mind knows what's going on. And the area of your high chest and throat is where most people store feelings of sadness and grief. So if people are experiencing heaviness, in their high chest or a kind of a closedness or a lump in their throat, that's very often an indicator that they're sad. And they can start getting curious about what they're sad about, or even just giving themselves loving attention for feeling the body sensations that they're feeling will often then open up that discovery, and they can find out what they are actually sad about. And then the area around the navel, around your belly button, particularly if people are experiencing kind of racy, queasy, or butterfly feelings, is an indicator of fear. And if people learn to notice the sensations in those three areas and speak about them, not even having to interpret them or figure out what they're about, but just simply noticing and expressing to their partner, you know, I notice that my jaw is tight. I'm wondering what that's about. That begins to open up then a bridge between I don't have any idea what's going on, and actually being able to notice and communicate about your feelings. And we've taught, you know, hundreds of people how to do this, and so we know it's something that anybody can learn if they just give some time and attention. And there's tremendous value in being able to be with your feelings, be present with them, and to communicate about those to your partner. It's one of the best ways to create intimacy. One of the things we also like to be sure that partners know is that if you're feeling angry, there's almost always something else underneath that. So it's fine to say, you know, I feel angry at you today, but to also wonder, what is it that I'm scared about? Because we've seen over and over again that when people are angry, there's almost always something that they're sad about or that they're angry about, I mean, that they're scared about, that when they communicate about that, they feel more connected to themselves and more connected to their partners.
That's really great. Well, I wish we had another hour to talk, but unfortunately we have about 3 minutes left. I would love to have you talk a little bit about the Gaia Illumination University, and I think we'll just have to have another show to talk about things like upper limits and projections and all the other things I had on my list that I wanted to talk to you about today. But let's talk about the Gaia Illumination University. That's something new that you're starting there. Can you address that a little, Gay?
I sure can, yes. Starting a year or so ago, or maybe even earlier than that, we began to realize that we wanted to provide more opportunities for people to learn about relationship and self-esteem and manifestation, the kinds of things that people learn in our seminars, but we wanted to find ways for people around the world who might not be able to make it to Esalen or to here in California where we live or to wherever we teach, we wanted to create online opportunities for how to do that. And so we developed a number of what we call cyber courses or e-courses that are self-paced, and they are you work your way through them. They're audio, video, text, experiential activities, but you can do them in your pajamas, you know, at 11 o'clock at night or at your desk over lunch hour. And so we gradually put all of these together. We developed 10 or 11 different courses, and now most of them reside within an online university called Gaia Illumination University and can be accessed at GaiaIlluminationUniversity.com. So people can come there, and we have about 1,000 or so students now already that are there working through classes at their own pace on manifestation, relationship, self-esteem, conscious weight loss, all sorts of different things that people would have to spend thousands and thousands of dollars to come and take a seminar and learn or to travel here, but they can do them online for a modest subscription price, about $4 a week. And so they can have access to all of the different courses that we offer online.
That's great. And Gaia is spelled G-A-I-A.
Yes.
IlluminationUniversity.com.
That's correct. And,
that's right.
So
I'm going to need to wrap it up now, and Katie, I'm going to give you the last word. What's the most important thing to you about relationships?
I think the most important thing is to love yourself for whatever you're experiencing, to give yourself a moment of loving appreciation for whatever you're experiencing, and then to let yourself focus on what do I really want and begin moving in that direction.
Gay and Katie Hendricks, thank you so much for being on Conversations. It's been great. I hope to do it again with you soon.
Thanks, Michael.
All right, good.
Take care. Bye-bye. All right. Well, another hour seems to have slipped by again. I just want you to know that on January 14th, I'll have Jean Houston on Discovering the Mystery Within. January 20th, Alexander Cousteau. And a special pledge drive, David Corton has a new book out, Agenda for a New Economy. Don't miss it on Pledge Day. And you're welcome to pledge. I want to thank you all for the incredible pledging you did last time. And big thanks to Jeannie Toffanelli Home Loans, serving the KVMR, KVMR listening area with home financing since 1986. Consultations aim to provide sustainable financing and solutions to the homeowner, purchaser, builder, investor, and those with unusual circumstances. Jeannie can be reached at 346-9713. And also a big thanks to Sierra Solar Systems, serving the foothills and the environment for 28 years. Their solar-powered showroom and warehouses at the Alternative Building Center, 563 Idaho Maryland Road, Grass Valley, 530-273-6754. That's sierrasolar.com. You can find out more about the upcoming shows by going to my website, arewelistening.net, arewelistening.net. And also, I recommend signing up for the newsletter where you can catch up on all the old shows by going to arewelistening.net. Thank you so much for listening. As always, it's a joy to be with you. Blessings, and I'll be with you soon. Thank you.